Okay, that's nice. So you have taught and researched extensively, obviously, on women and the media. Your previous publications have mainly focused on representation of social class and the role of women in broadcasting. I was given to understand that you are currently working on a book based on archive research and interviews involving a comparative historical study of the politics of the production process in television drama, both in France and in Britain. And this is a direct transition towards your talk today, since you're going to make a presentation about TV drama in Britain and France in the 1950s and 1960s. So the floor is yours for 30 minutes.
Okay, thank you. Well, there's quite a lot to get through, and so I'll start immediately to say that whilst the BBC anniversary is the springboard for these seminars, the British Broadcasting Corporation has always held the genre of drama as a central thread for personnel and programming. And this applied in radio and eventually in the new kid on the block of the time, television. So I shall begin by outlining the changes and development in the context and production processes of television drama in Britain and then in France in this establishing period. I want to say that a comparative approach can highlight the approaches, creative decision-making of practitioners in what was a new technology environment. I shall look at how both in the French and British context, directors, writers, producers, script editors were able to push against and utilise the limits imposed by political and institutional constraints, using the dominant social and cultural ideas in the creation of new directions for television drama. Oops. Next paragraph is about the anti-television BBC, not the anti-BBC television. The BBC, in its 100-year history, has been imbued with the image of a national institution, somehow kindly and firmly benevolent, presenting programmes and themes integral to the culture of the people. But a closer look at the structures, people and policies shaping television drama output during the establishment decades of the 50s and 60s. It reveals initially internal disagreements and pressures by management figures, including a director general of the time, Sir William Hayley. The BBC problem in BBC acceptance of the validity of television itself is described by Michael Barry, head of TV drama in 1952, as the intellectual disdain for television prevalent among the top managers of the BBC. And this was a form of intellectual snobbery, according to Asa Briggs, the BBC historian, in which the high culture objective of Sir William Hayley was the raising of public taste, with TV as a threat to this. Claude Santelli, a writer and director in France at the time, describes a similar attitude when he says men of letters had a disdain for television in the 1950s. It was too vulgar for them. And he told me that in a personal interview some time ago. A more flexible approach towards television and drama, the BBC, arrived in 1952 with a different director general, Ian Jacob. More progress was made later when Hugh Green arrived in that position in 1960, overseeing the start of a BBC TV channel in 1964. But during all this time, spaces began to develop for practitioners to innovate and to shift the focus of drama to connect with the interests of the wider public and more viewers. A public which had earlier, in 1953, suddenly increased in both Britain and France due to the huge popularity of the dramatic television spectacular, The Queen's Coronation. So we get to Launchpad and the Takeoff. Whereas in France, the director was the key figure for television drama at this time, in Britain, the writer was the initial creator. Experimental approaches for television drama emerged after disputes within the BBC hierarchy resulted in a project to encourage new writers. Nigel Neal was a prime mover, responsible for the three Quatermass science fiction serials broadcast over the decade of the 50s, with Rudolf Cartier as producer. This was a clear indication of a shift towards British popular culture genre for television. to be continued later in the decade with a feminine focus in sci-fi with A for Andromeda. A speech, a powerful speech, by Professor Quatermass at the end of the third Quatermass series indicates how drama programs can have significance to present-day events, even if doomy and gloomy, as he says. Every war crisis, witch hunt, race riot, purge is a reminder and warning. We are the Martians. If we cannot control the inheritance within us, this will be the second dead planet. However, the important cue for developing and expanding drama output at the BBC came with the threat of competition and possible change to the licence fee on the arrival of commercial television in 1955. The simultaneous expansion of transmission networks across Britain meant that an even wider potential public was created. Television drama in series, one-off plays and serial form became a crucial factor in drawing and keeping a regular audience. And in this first decade, the BBC was far ahead of ITV in terms of the output of drama series and serials, with most of these written especially for television. Just before the start of ITV, the BBC launched The Grove Family in 1954, a short, regular output of drama aimed at family viewing, otherwise known as a feuilleton or soap opera. What became the popular genre of police series was also launched with initially the one-dimensional friendly neighborhood policeman Dixon Duck Green, and later the more dynamic Z cars from the influential team Troy Kennedy Martin and John Hopkins. The long-standing tradition of classical literature adaptations also continued, especially the works of Charles Dickens, very popular in 2021 television also. These things continue. So, I'm going to talk about writers, realism, and social class in Britain initially. So the awareness of social class and the need to address the new and expanding audience was a central motivating factor for writers and directors in television drama in both France and Britain at this time. There was no libération génération of directors in Britain, as there was in France at the time, but other factors led to an emphasis on the class identity of programmes and of viewers. The power of television drama to provoke major debates and political controversy had been demonstrated early on in 1950 when Party Manners, a political comedy written by the head of the BBC Drama Department, was banned from a second transmission of its live performance by the chairman of governors of the BBC, Lord Simon Withenshaw, on the grounds that it was offensive to the Labour Party. Nevertheless, the BBC yearbook for 1951 noted an increase in the number of plays written specially for television, with a new BBC script department starting up with a small informal group at the time. There were push-pull factors which gradually fed into the situation. So the start of a commercial competitor in 1955 was a challenge to BBC executives to restructure programming and to win viewers back into the fold. A key factor was the wider working class nature of the audience, with expectations of a different use of language and subject matter in the field of drama. An unexpected but profound influence, I have to mention, came from the new school of theatre dramatists in Britain, labelled the Angry Young Men, including John Osborne, Brendan Meehan, who broke the rules and presented a challenge, often politically charged, to the elitist conventions of established theatre productions. In addition, political events locally and worldwide also influenced writers for television. Troy Kennedy Martin's first play for television, Incident at Echo 6, broadcast by the BBC in 1958, concerned the involvement of British national servicemen in the Cyprus conflict. However, finding writers for television drama was difficult, and this was underlined by Irene Shubik, one of the few women practitioners of the time, story editor and producer in the 1960s, of BBC's long-running one-off drama slot, The Wednesday Play. She told me, finding good writers was always difficult. I think people were scared of the medium. And as one writer observed at the time, television needs the writer even more than he needs television. She as well. The need for writers with a certain commitment is described by Don Taylor, writer and director in television drama. He describes the motivation of new writers and directors in television with working class backgrounds who were eager to use these opportunities to communicate with this wider audience of viewers for drama. It was necessary, he said, to get onto the screen radical questioning work, which at that time was likely to be, as he said, a product of the upsurge of interest in the real life of the working class from playwrights who knew that background. This echoes the views of influential American playwright Paddy Chayefsky, writing in 1955 about what he called the world of the mundane, the untheatrical, the marvellous world of the ordinary. The repertoire of the present in television fiction of that time put the emphasis on the immediacy of everyday life, and the language for communicating this underlined the importance of the vernacular, with a fundamental innovation in the use of dialects and accents rooted in specific socio-cultural contexts. The television drama output from Wales, BBC Wales, for example, even before the start of a Welsh language channel, presented dramatic narratives of Welsh working class life, as in Going Like a Fox, written by Alan Richards, and broadcast in 1960 from Cardiff, BBC Wales. Liverpool Welsh writer Alan Owen had worked as a coal miner and then as an actor in theatre and television. He expressed his motivation close to that of Marcel Bluval, director at the time in France, in his statement, "I like writing for television because of the audience. Most people have a television set, but few and far between are the people who go to theatre. The vast majority of people in this country are working class people. I am of and from that class, and they are the people I write for." An important shift towards this philosophy emerged in 1963 with Sidney Newman's arrival as head of BBC Drama. He was poached from ITV after his previous successful launch of the Armchair Theatre series for commercial television. He was motivated by the need to draw audiences from the competitor back to viewing BBC Drama, even at a cost of political outspokenness. In his words, the focus of television drama had to be about the very people who own TV sets, which is really a working class audience. So class, community, social fragmentation, and education became central themes in television drama, with family relationships often the pivot on which these issues turned. In this respect, David Mercer was one of several writers who wrote from personal experience on the theme of cultural and emotional splits in working class families, where the new generation was the first in the post-war period to benefit from university education. His play, Where the Difference Begins, was part of a trilogy for BBC television broadcasts in 1961 and 62. One of the few women writers of the time, Julia Jones, dealt with a similar theme in the narrative of so-called everyday life. A Designing Woman was about a young woman in Lancashire concealing her interest in art and her talent as an artist due to opposition to such fantasy activities by her husband and uncle. Julia Jones included script instructions for the regional voice of her characters. "Is Lancashire is rich and rolling." Tony Garnett, producer, story editor, and major contributor, Ken Loach, to the shaping of TV drama, worked on this. And he commented that in this play, Julia Jones, his words, reveals how extraordinary, ordinary people are. That there is no such thing as an ordinary person. A dark approach to, however, to the 1960 dramas of domestic life could be seen in John Hopkins' quartet of plays, Talking to a Stranger, where he was using tightly structured dialogue, often overlapping, and significant silences, conveying the alienation and crisis of communication in a critique of claustrophobic family life. This innovative approach to the technology, appropriating the established codes to convey different sets of meaning, was also shown in the mid-1960s plays written by Dennis Potter. The Nigel Barton dramas focused on issues of class and politics, blurring the lines between programme genres, including news, studio discussions, and used direct address to camera to maximise the impact on the viewers he wanted to reach. And in his words, in small family groupings, both coal miners and Oxford dons. However, the push of writers using television codes creatively to explore new forms of drama is balanced against the pull factor of television organisations, including the BBC, to provide programmes, drama programmes, which would attract audiences. But there were also political boundaries to this, which I'll finish on the English part of this, as shown in the refusal of the BBC in 1965 to transmit The War Game, a powerful anti-nuclear war drama by Peter Watkins, which is only allowed to be transmitted decades later. So, a paragraph on control of the technology, live or not live. Aesthetic as well as political issues were attached to the initial technology. Jean Darcy, head of television programs in 1952, was sympathetic to the notion of live television as a new art form, maybe challenging the dominant role of cinema. He told historian Jérôme Bourdon, "La caméra de direct est présentée comme un instrument de vérité et d'authenticité extraordinaire." A similar view of special meanings in drama broadcast live came in the same year from Michael Barry, head of television drama. "The errors we might commit, like the good things, were transmitted directly into the homes of our viewers. There could be no error. The audacity was breathtaking." However, the initial dependence on live transmission was seen by some drama directors, Garnison Loach in Britain and Celio Lorenzi in France, as a limitation to creative possibilities, while to others it was seen as a covert system of freedom from below, enabling the production team to exert their control and to avoid interference from above. When live programmes were controlled by the director, if management wanted to censor or stop the drama at the last minute, viewers would have a blank screen, and only if there was a planned second performance could this be cancelled, allowing advance warning for a replacement. This political dimension of live transmission, pre-video control, was described to me by Marcel Bluval, drama director, when he said, and I, the quotations from most of my French interviewees are translated into English for this event, and Marcel Bluval, on this issue of pre-video control, he said, "One could push down the levers, and we could say, that won't do during a strike." So there was a real power game, he said. And this was particularly relevant to the period 1954-60-64, when there were several strikes by drama directors in protest against political victimization of colleagues. So the takeoff point in France, I shall speak about next. The post-war availability of television in France was extremely limited, with the view by the authorities initially, as in Britain, that radio was more important than television, and favouring major cities for television reception and access. The takeoff point for French television came in 1953 with a five-year plan and government funds allocated for television development. But the most significant factor for drama output was the era of Jean Darcy, 1952 to 1959, as the first director of television programmes in French television. This was a management position. As I explained, he was passionate about television as a new art form, and it followed from this that he encouraged drama productions. In particular, he showed support for the work of the keen but small group of 10 young drama directors for television, known as the Libération Génération. A new government statute in 1958-59 for Radio Diffusion Télévision Française also brought Albert Olivier as director of television programs. And he promoted the use of film and production outside the studio context. He was generally sympathetic to drama output, as long as it wasn't too leftist. The statute of 1964-65 establishing ORTF began a new phase with Claude Contamine as director of television programs. And he demonstrated an explicitly hostile attitude to the principal drama series of the time and some of the directors of the time on political grounds. My next paragraph is about television drama for the people. And here I shall talk mainly about the work of the directors who laid the ground for an innovative and productive period in French television drama. Whereas in Britain at this time, the writer on a small scale became the key innovator of television drama, in France it was this young group, which I mentioned already, of mainly film school graduates. And in the post-war period, they were known, well, post-war being significant in the term of Libération, Génération. Initially, they worked across different sections of a relatively small organisation for television, and with gradual expansion of the system, they adapted and directed works of classical literature and also became responsible for original television drama productions. As graduates of the film school, they were strongly influenced by cinema and saw themselves as auteurs. There were few original dramas in the early period, but these included the work of Marcel Moret, one of the few feminine writers of television drama at the time. A significant expansion of drama output, however, occurred during these two decades, including a popular format which Darcy described as a rendezvous with viewers on a regular basis, the feuilleton. But whilst continuity of characters and settings marked out the genre, in France there were often historical themes. According to historian Isabelle Vera-Masson, les feuilletons sont donc bien le genre privilégié de l'histoire à la télévision, comme inversement, l'histoire est le thème favori des feuilletons. One of the most famous of these was Stelio Lorenzi's production, Jacques Le Croquant, with a peasant hero, whose name was invoked in a contemporary campaign by peasant farmers and agricultural workers. Serialized adaptations of literary classics had been popular in Britain, but in France were seen by the Libération Génération directors as having the potential for a creative and political dimension. These classical adaptations could be given contemporary interpretation and coded criticism. As Marcel Bluval explained to me, you mask it beforehand. In fact, you talk about the present. At a time of great censorship in France, with the Gaullists in 1958, for example, it was difficult to speak about the present, really. We talked about that through the past. The ideas and the cultural commitments of these directors showed the same social and communication influences and objectives as the dramatists for the BBC, which I discussed earlier. And Bluval said, "We were there not only for the arts, but for the educational reasons too. We did not put ourselves at the level of the university professor. We were the people's teachers, Salon Noir," he originally said. "The people had a right to knowledge, and it appeared to us that television was the ideal instrument, of which an extraordinary number of literary works were done for French television," he said, "to put the world repertoire, past and present, at the disposal of a new public who had never seen it. That was important. A public who had never read," and he said, "who were miners or dressmakers." Okay, teamwork. I'm going to go on to teamwork, interactive drama, and politics. A turning point came in 1956 for all that, in the same year when André Franck was appointed as the first head of drama. And again, according to Marcel Bluval, Jean Darcy met with four of us one day in his office. He asked me for ideas. He was fed up with the repertoire. That was enough. Now we had to write series. We went to find writers. And this appeal resulted in a new collaborative way of working involving director, writer, script editor teams, and some groundbreaking new series. Écriture par l'image was a key element in the approach of these directors, an objective made possible by the development of new lightweight technology. And here are three major examples where this concept took away reality to television viewers by means of the evolving conventions of television drama had a major significance in the work of these directors. So I'm going to briefly describe to you three of these series. Si c'était vous was broadcast in 1957 as a series of four separate dramas directed by Marcel Bluval and co-written by Marcel Moussy. These programs represent an early example of social realist television drama in France, dealing with subjects including teenage rebellion, housing problems, class discrimination faced by a working class student who wants to become a doctor, and finally, the problems of a young woman moving from the countryside to Paris and facing multiple problems, including pregnancy and abortion, a taboo subject in the 1950s. Britain as well as in France. Each drama ended with a direct address to viewers, intended to generate an interactive, participative approach, and requesting suggestions for future program subjects. Marcel Moussy explains why this series ended. "We had planned to tackle the problem of the Algerian conscripts in Algeria, and then the office of the director said no. As long as you provided a social alibi for television, talked about the problems of parents and children. Everything was okay. Marcel Mussi himself then went on to write the film script for the Truffaut film, Les Quatre Cent Coups. Right, but the next TV series I'm going to deal with is called Les Cinq Dernières Minutes, Policier, Detective Story, which started in 1958 and went on to become one of the longest-running television series ever, described by Christian Bosseno, television historian, as un des plus importants ateliers de la fiction à la télévision. The trio of Claude Dorsay, Henri Grange, and André Mailleux were the key initiators of this series, where viewers were asked directly to be involved in the investigation, even with viewer representatives in the studio asked to work out the identity of the culprit, helping Inspector Borel. That would be familiar to many people, I think. And that technique of involvement of the audience is very popular today. Now, the next series I'm going to deal with is called La Camera, Explore le Temps. It's the last series I'll deal with, given the time spectrum. La Camera, Explore le Temps used a combination of epic and intimate documentary and dramatic approaches developed by the team led by Stelio Lorenzi, Deco and Gastillo. Michelle Oglore was an important member of this team in her key role as script editor and assistant to Lorenzi. The rationale of the series was to question established historical accounts using newly researched material with dramatic reconstructions to discover material hidden from history, a popular television format today. It was largely studio-based and broadcast live. The subjects included Napoleon's affair with Maria Malevska, the assassination of Henry IV, the French Revolution. The dramatic reconstruction, however, of the 13th century attack by Simon de Montfort against the so-called heresy of the Cathares provoked a huge response in the area of the Languedoc, with thousands going to tribute events for the victims of the attacks, and also a movement to revive the culture and politics of the Occitane. The series ran for nearly a decade with 38 programs and enormous popularity with viewers who protested when it was stopped by the authorities in 1966. And this was a political intervention to censor the historical interpretations of the series and the apparently left-wing views of the production team. In conclusion, I will recount the following. Alain Perrefitte, Minister of Information, 1962-65, has described, according to the Institut Charles de Gaulle, a conversation he had with President de Gaulle. When are you going to show them the door? Your left-wing journalists, your left-wing cameraman, your left-wing directors. Perrefitte would reply, my general, if I kick them out, there will be no one left. So, one more thing. Where are the women, you might say, and what about Black Lives Matter? This era was problematic for both categories of practitioners. In France, more women became writers, directors, producers over the following two decades. But even in the 1960s, a few women were there, including Nina Companies, responsible for many productions from the 1960s to the 2000s. Eliane Victor, initiator of documentary series. Les Femmes Aussi. Marie-Claire Schaeffer, Idec graduate. Denise Brion, Nina Companies, Geneviève Bastide, Françoise Vernier, Simone Barnier are some of the names previously hidden who became practitioners at this time. And research should be done on the presence of BAME practitioners. So I'll finish on that. Thank you, everyone. And, oh, yes, also, like yesterday's, thank you to Bibliothèque Nationale à Paris and Ina Dans le Temps. The directors and writers who were willing to talk to me some time ago when I was doing my research for my doctoral thesis. Anyway, thanks for listening, everyone.
Thank you, Joy. That was really interesting. And I'm quite struck by this constant worries of authorities about cultural decadence when connected to new technologies. We heard about that yesterday with the BBC radio format, and this is what you're also telling us here with the BBC TV medium. So that's and that's quite interesting to hear you say that the BBC was led somehow to climb down from its pedestal because of the hope to reach wider audiences, and they were led somehow to give up their snobbery and disdain to have access to a wider range of spectators from the working class in particular. Yes, maybe there is a question from Charlotte. Well, that's maybe a wide question. I don't know if you can answer that. Charlotte asks, can writers for the BBC series be described as showrunners? Because I know that it's a term that comes from the US rather than from the UK, indeed.
Yeah, I don't really recognise that term. But if you mean, did they make a difference? Well, yes, they certainly made a difference. But they weren't always treated very well by the BBC. They didn't always have contracts for a very long time. They weren't always paid very well. They made a huge difference. That's why I put the emphasis on writer rather than producer director, although things obviously people like Garnett and Loach, when they work together, which I think the next presentation will touch on, that writing there was incorporated with the directing process as well.
I see that John, you have a question for Joy.
Thank you very much, Joy. It was very exciting to see some comparison, because we've all been working very much on the BBC this last year or two, but very often we've been looking at it as something very unique and national, and we've had little chance to look elsewhere. And so I had a very general question for you. You've explained the different dynamics which affected drama writers and producers in France and in Britain. That when they wanted to put forward working class experience and other aspects of social reality. Now, would you say, if you took the general couple of decades, that once you have a creative team that wants to do this, they find a way within the institution? Or would you say that the institutional framework in Britain with the BBC and in France was really very different and made a big difference? That what I mean to say is that did the French institutional framework or the British institutional framework make it easier for these creative teams, one than the other, or did it really not make a lot of difference?
Well, no, it was quite crucial because, ironically, of course, commercial elements didn't come into French TV control or output until some years later. And partly the commercial push, if you like, for the BBC to gain audiences from a commercial competitor, which forced them into a new situation to appeal to more writers and a different mode of address, if you like, in the mid-1950s onwards. Whereas in France, that didn't happen until a bit later, and the kind of political framework and control was then much more forceful in a way in France because they didn't want the voices of the directors, the writers, and so on to be too much in opposition to the dominant, for the government anyway, the dominant political principles that they wanted to uphold.
Oh, thank you very much. And I just wanted to remind people that the plays of Dennis Potter done for the BBC are available on YouTube, so you can actually watch them anytime.